Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
What possible reason could there be for such inhumanity? And why is such madness permitted to continue despite the calls for action? There are unlimited excuses and a near total lack of will. Why? It seems the disasters of our time, despite our drive for ultra-technological wizardry that drives the global good news, keep asserting their truth. Stay tuned. The Darfur Diaries continue with Adam Shapiro. One of the components that people claim is driving this, and I would appreciate your perspective on this, is that there is a fairly strong ethnic difference between what is referred to as the Northern Sudan and Southern Sudan and Darfur. And some people would say that the Northern Sudan is more reflective of the Arab and Muslim elements than the Southern Sudanese, and people in Darfur are more associated with Christian and animist traditions. Help us understand that. Give me your perspective.
Well, there certainly are differences among the different tribes and peoples of Sudan. There are more than 60 tribal groupings, and among the 60 you find there are linguistic differences, there are what could be called ethnic differences, what could be called certainly religious differences. However, the fight, for instance, historically between the North and the South was never about religion per se. It was about and if you ask, John Durang, unfortunately, was passed away, but the people who've taken Salva Kiir, for instance, who took his place, he would tell you the fight was never about religion. The government of Sudan was using religion, depicting the conflict as a Muslim versus Christian battle, as a way of mobilizing support for itself. So it was looking to mobilize support among Muslims in Sudan to fight against the Southerners. And it was using it internationally to seek support from fellow Muslim nations to support the government of Sudan in its campaign against the South. And in Darfur, you can't use the Muslim-Christian dichotomy because everybody in Darfur is Muslim. So instead, what's been used by the government is the notion that this is an Arab versus African conflict. And so, trying to depict the tribes in Darfur who are the ones who have primarily been attacked as African, and the government and its affiliated militias as Arab. And so and that has been used to try to mobilize support in the north of Sudan among people who typically refer to themselves as Arab, as well as in the Arab world to try to secure support from Arab countries for the regime. However, if you ask the people in Darfur, as we did, what do you consider yourself? Are you African? Are you Arab? What's the difference? They'll tell you, look, we speak Arabic, so therefore we are Arabs. And it's true. I mean, historically, being an Arab never had anything to do with, or at least not in after the 19th century, had anything to do with where you were from or what you were ethnically or racially. Being Arab, according to the Arab Nationalist Movement, had to do with whether or not you spoke the Arabic language, and as such, it was an inclusive effort to at nationalism to include Christians, Muslims, Jews, even Druze and other religious groups, as well as ethnic groups, including Berbers and African, people, African tribesmen in Sudan and in Mauritania and elsewhere. To link them together with people from the Arabian Peninsula, from Iraq, from Syria, from Lebanon, all of these places in one large sort of nationalist linguistic grouping. Additionally, the people in Darfur will tell you, look, the people who are in the north of our country all live in Africa, and we are all Africans. And there's no difference between us racially or ethnically. And you'll find that as well in the north, if you talk to people in Khartoum, they'll tell you that, look, we are all African, we are all Arab because we speak the same language. And so this notion that there's a difference is something that's been created for political consumption and as a means of mobilizing one against the other. And really it's being used by the government to generate support for itself.
But what is the motivation of that government that is spinning all of these agendas? Why is this happening?
Well, they are very small. The government represents a very small ruling elite, and the current rulers came to power by virtue of a military coup in 1989. And so their sources of support are a few large families that are home in the northern part of the country, as well as some elements of the military. In order for them to hold on to power, in order for them to maintain their tight grip of control over the resources of the country, and there are increasingly, it's become known that there's greater oil reserves in Sudan than were previously thought, so there are a decent amount of economic resources there. In order for this regime to hold on to power, it needs to keep others out of sharing that power, because in the end, this regime, this ruling elite, is a minority, and a very small minority in the country. And so if other groups were to share power, if other regions were to share power, there would be much less power resources available for this ruling elite, and it's not ready to give up power. It's not ready to share with others. And so the only way for it to maintain its grip on power is to keep the country in a form of chaos. And the way it's done that is by promoting these divisions within the country, by trying to prevent groups from unifying with each other, both regional groups and tribal groups from unifying with each other, and organizing to form a more representative government that would represent both the regional characteristics of the country as well as tribal and religious characteristics of the country.
So where are they gaining their support from? Who is supporting the government in Khartoum?
Well, you have the support certainly from other Arab governments who bought into this sort of Arab-African dichotomy. And then, interestingly, simultaneously, you also have support from the African Union, which would seem to be on the face of it somewhat bizarre, because they're playing off their own identity. The government is playing it off its own identity as an Arab government, not as an African government, and yet it is a player in the African Union. It is an African government, and like many other African governments, is not democratically elected, and so it can gain some support and solidarity from other regimes on the continent. And then beyond that, certainly China and Russia have extensive investments and interest in the country, both for its oil as well as military contracts, export of various products and whatnot. So, you know, there are, beyond just simply the Arab and African world, supports for this regime in the international community. And then finally, as I mentioned earlier, the United States, although it still considers Sudan to be, it's a country that's still on the list of terror-supporting countries, also simultaneously is considered a partner in the war on terror, by sharing intelligence and information that it has gathered. It's well known by now that Osama bin Laden found home in Sudan up until 1996. And so, you know, there are some in the U.S. government who value the Sudanese government's ability to provide information with regards to Al-Qaeda or other, you know, groups that it's interested in.
Now, there are some sort of breaking developments that we keep hearing about these days. Suddenly, Darfur is on the radar screen, and the United Nations is becoming involved. The United States is becoming involved. What do you see, what are you hearing right now, and what do you think is the projection for the future here, let's say, in the next number of months?
Well, there was recently this peace agreement signed in Abuja that was signed by the government of Sudan as well as one of the rebel factions. A number of the other rebel factions have actually rejected the deal, saying that it is insufficient to generate real peace in Darfur, and have made a good case as to why that is. The UN, as part of this deal, it got wrapped into the deal, but separately, the UN was pushing for deploying a peacekeeping force in Darfur to replace the African Union mission that is there just simply as observers. But it's very unclear as to what exactly this UN force would look like. The U.S. has already said it will not send troops to to Sudan. There's a great reluctance on the part of European powers at this point, who are already well deployed in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other places, like the French, for instance, are deployed in Ivory Coast. The British are deployed in Sierra Leone and Liberia, I believe. So there's not many troops available if we're talking about Western countries or if we're talking about these European countries and the United States. And so the question then remains, well, where will troops come from? The largest UN mission is currently in the Congo right next door, and certainly has its significant problems there in terms of maintaining numbers of peacekeeping forces, as well as in terms of what those peacekeeping forces are doing. There's actually been a number of crimes, committed by those peacekeeping forces on the ground, including sex trafficking and drug running and a number of things like that. So there's actually great concern over what kind of UN forces could be, how robust it would be, and then finally, the government of Sudan so far has still not agreed to actually having a UN force on the ground. So all of that is still up in the air, and it's not quite certain when or if this might move forward.
So the bottom line, sort of, is the fact that in essence, nothing effective is going to happen in the near future. And unless I'm mistaken, I believe the slaughtering still continues. And am I right about that?
Yeah, indeed. Since the peace agreement has been signed, Janjaweed militias have been conducting a number of raids and attacks. Additionally, the one rebel faction that did sign on to the agreement has actually conducted attacks against representatives and civilians who are followers of the other rebel faction. So it's becoming, it was already a big mess politically, and also, of course, you know, the civilians are suffering all kinds of horrors, and now it just seems to be getting even worse.
If you could wave that magic wand, what would you recommend?
Well, somebody needs, the government of Sudan needs to be held accountable, and that ultimately is what it comes down to. The government of Sudan escaped accountability for for the war it conducted against the people of the South for over 30 years by virtue of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, and in fact it was a signatory to the agreement and was treated to all kinds of kudos by the international community for signing the agreement, ending a war in which well over a million people were killed, all kinds of atrocities were committed, and basically nobody was held accountable for those atrocities. So the government has a track record. It has a track record of escaping any sort of accountability or responsibility for its actions, and this is at heart the problem in Sudan. And so unless the international community is willing to, including the African Union and including the Arab League, are willing to deal with this regime as a criminal regime, which it really is, and looking at the country as a whole, well, these problems will persist, if not in Darfur, then in another region of the country. And so this is where I think the fault lines are. And I don't know if there is a magic wand, but certainly, dealing with this regime in an honest and direct way is one place to start.
Well, Adam Shapira, you, along with Aisha Bain and Jane Marlowe, co-produced a film that really takes a look at this on a very personal level, which is called Darfur Diaries. When people want to find out about where this may be showing, or if they wish to schedule a showing, what's the best way for them to contact you and make that happen?
All the information is available on our website, which is www.darfurdiaries.org. And on there is information about the film, about the places we went to, and how to schedule a screening and to get in touch with us.
Well, I wish we had about three more hours, but our time is up. Adam Shapira, I want to thank you so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you for having me again.
Every day, in various areas of our earth, refugees are arriving from the ravaging mysteries of inhumanity. You can help by looking in your own communities and giving whatever you have to assist in rehumanizing the gracious people of the Sudan. And at the same time, waste not a moment more. Write, talk, demand, raise your voice, maybe raise your fist at the towers of power to take back our soul of a nation. Because every day that passes finds us slipping deeper and deeper to sleep. into a hypnotizing morass of a fractured spirit. Many would say, it cannot be by design, no. And therefore we're left with this. We can blame no one but ourselves. Awaken, rise up, take back our reason. Don't wait a moment longer. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Thursday or anytime on the archives, when your voice of the earth speaks out here on the Wild Side News.